Welcome to the Logic Consortium. Today we are speaking with Dr. Jeffrey Friedman, political scientist, author, and editor of the scholarly journal Critical Review, about his book Engineering the Financial Crisis, which he wrote in 2011 with economist Vladimir Krauss. In the book, they review the many theories that have been put forward about the causes of the financial crisis, analyzing each theory's validity and identifying what they believe to be the most convincing arguments. So thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Friedman. And here we start off by asking him to begin with a summary of the book and how it fits into his journal's overall scholarly agenda.
I think that without getting too deep into the technicalities, as you know, the book kind of goes deeply into, the takeaway point and really the thing that got me started in writing this book, even though I'm not an economist, so I really kind of am not qualified to write such a book. But I did edit this special issue of Critical Review on the financial crisis and learned from a couple of articles by economists a couple of things that stuck with me and that I just did not see either them or anybody else following up on. I don't have any experience investing in bonds, but I think the one thing that is useful to know about bonds, even if you never are going to invest in them, is that the higher the rating, the lower they pay. That's because a high rating is for safety, and you get paid for taking risk. So if you have a junk bond that's rated B, you get paid a lot more by that bond. You get a lot more interest than if it's rated AAA. So back during the early days of the crisis, like everybody else, I had heard about how the banks had gotten in trouble by investing in AAA-rated mortgage-backed securities. And then I learned, as I edited this issue of Critical Review, that AAA-rated bonds pay very little. They paid barely anything over treasuries, which is the standard. Treasuries pay the least because they're supposed to be absolutely invincibly safe. So then everyone became convinced that greedy, reckless bankers had caused the financial crisis. And it struck me that a greedy, reckless banker would probably buy a junk bond or a double A or a single A or a triple B bond. And all of these types of mortgage-backed bonds were available. But what they wanted and bought in huge quantities were triple A bonds. I think that one fact pretty much falsifies the conventional views about the financial crisis. There are other things about the behavior of the bankers that are inconsistent with the conventional view that they were reckless and greedy, but the main thing is a reckless, greedy banker would buy as low-rated a bond as possible. So apparently, the bankers were being pretty prudent. They were buying AAA-rated bonds, and these bonds weren't just in the opinion of a rating agency safe. They were actually legally structured so that AAA bondholders got paid completely before any AA bondholders got paid. You can see how not just bankers, but pension funds and all sorts of institutional investors would have thought this was a great idea, because in a way it was. What they didn't anticipate was that they were investing into a housing bubble. But the regulators didn't anticipate that either, and people like Ben Bernanke were saying as late as 2006 that there isn't a nationwide housing bubble, it's just local housing bubbles. That was the conventional wisdom. There are more details that we go into in the book. The one, I guess, that's essential to making the comparison, the larger comparison, that gets beyond the financial crisis, is that in 2001, the American financial regulators passed a regulation that actually penalized banks that did not invest in AAA or AA-rated mortgage-backed securities. So a bank that wanted to lend to businesses was penalized compared to a bank that wanted to make mortgage loans. And a bank that made mortgage loans and then kept the individual mortgages was penalized compared to a bank that sold the mortgages to be packaged into a mortgage-backed bond and then bought them back as long as it was rated at AA or AAA. So the regulators understood that these bonds, because of the way that they were structured, were a very safe investment, and part of their regulatory mandate is trying to ensure that banks don't go bankrupt. The FDIC is one of these regulators. So they passed this regulation penalizing banks that didn't invest in these securities. We show in the book that that banks, compared to other investors, had three times as many of these bonds as other investors who could have bought the bonds. And that is an initial indication that the regulation that was passed in 2001, which is called the recourse rule, worked. The regulators wanted banks to buy the bonds, and they bought the bonds. So it wasn't reckless, greedy bankers. It was bankers who didn't realize they were investing into a mortgage bubble, buying exactly the type of bonds that regulators encouraged them to buy, because the regulators didn't realize that there could be a mortgage bubble. There had never been a significant American nationwide mortgage bubble before. So it seems as if there's a sort of standoff here. You've got ignorant bankers and ignorant regulators. And that is the larger project that I've been working on sort of all my life, at least for the last 20 years or so of my life, is thinking about the implications of ignorance for politics and economics. It's surprisingly something that most political scientists and economists don't think about. And if you look around at politics, the way it's conducted, rarely is ignorance considered a legitimate excuse or explanation for anything. Whenever anything goes wrong, somebody has to be blamed. And if somebody says, well, I made a mistake, I didn't realize that this it would work out that way, nobody believes them. There must be some deeper self-interested motive at work. And this seems to be the way that we are programmed to think about things. I mean, genetically programmed or culturally, I don't know which. But ignorance, generally speaking, is the last explanation that people seek in trying to explain behavior that they don't understand, especially a negative behavior. Another example is that in politics, people ascribe base motives to their political opponents rather than wondering whether their political opponents know the same things or think they know the same things that they do. So liberals think the conservatives are evil because liberals don't consider the conservatives maybe reading different newspapers, watching different TV programs, and therefore getting different information and thinking that the actual facts of the world are different than the facts that liberals know, and vice versa. Everybody does it to everybody else. The other guys are, to some extent, inexplicable, and instead of puzzling about that and wondering where they're getting their information, we blame them. We attribute some sort of sinister motive to other people. So both in politics and in economics, ignorance is an extremely understudied phenomenon. I think that in the financial crisis, you have this not face-off, but in evaluating things, you had a standoff. You had ignorant regulators and ignorant bankers. But I do think that it's not exactly a situation where we throw up our hands and say, well, you know, okay, everyone's fallible. Everyone is prone to ignorance, which I do definitely believe is the case. Therefore, nothing can be done about it, and what's the point in thinking about it? Because there is one difference between political actors who are ignorant and private sphere actors who are ignorant. And that is that if you make a mistake in your personal life, or if you're a banker and you make a mistake, your bank gets hurt by that. And you may also hurt other people indirectly through that. But when a regulator, say, makes a mistake, or the legislature makes a mistake, the entire society will suffer from that. I think that that's what happened in the financial crisis, quite the contrary of the conventional wisdom. A regulation was passed that basically homogenized the behavior of banks. It encouraged all banks to buy more mortgage-backed securities than they otherwise would have by penalizing them if they didn't. It was based on the same idea that a lot of bankers had, which is that these securities were safe. But bankers had different opinions about that. What the regulation did, as all regulations do, is it skewed everybody in the direction of the behavior that the regulators thought was desirable. So I do think that there is this problem, human ignorance, that has particular consequences in politics. And the moral of the story, I'm a little reluctant to draw this simple a moral of the story, but just to get the conversation started, the moral of the story is that to the extent that we can decentralize decision-making so that lots of different decisions are made by people who disagree with each other about what should be done, the net effect of that is to diminish the risk that the entire system will be brought down by one mistake. People will be making different mistakes, and the results will be a lot of bad consequences on a case-by-case basis, but the entire society won't be put at risk as often as when we centralize decision-making in the hands of politicians or regulators, and since they're fallible too, then we take a risk that they may be ignorant of something very important.
So we have this ignorance, and at the same time, so many people, economists especially, are asked to forecast future events when there are so many unknowns.
Yeah, well, I mean, it assumes that anyone can predict the future, we all are part of this. It's not just professional economists, but you know, we all as citizens are expected to have opinions about whatever the issues of the day are. And if you think about it, really, is reading the Tribune or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal enough to make you well-informed enough to have an opinion about things that even experts disagree with each other about? But we all are expected to be policy experts, in effect, in order to be able to vote intelligently or to answer an opinion survey intelligently. Economists are unique among social scientists in that they are routinely asked by politicians and journalists for their opinions more than ordinary citizens are asked. But whether you're asking an economist or an ordinary citizen, the problem is the same. We're all human beings. We're all fallible. Economists have models, very unrealistic models, that they use to try to predict what the effects of policies will be. We all have our own sort of implicit models of human behavior that we form by observing our own behavior and other people's behavior. The problem is that this country has more than 300 million people in it. Each person has a slightly different take on things because no two people get exactly the same stream of information from the moment they become conscious. And so you never really can predict how people will react to something new, whether it's a new situation that develops or a new law that's passed or a combination of things. New things are always happening, and people are reacting to them differently because they interpret them differently because everybody has their own ideas. So to predict human behavior, even predicting your husband or wife's behavior, is a fine art. Nobody is completely translucent to another person. We aren't even trying to understand our own behavior is sometimes difficult. So as citizens or as economists or policymakers, to be put in the position of expecting to know what effects a law will have, really it's asking more than human beings should be asked to do. Now, of course, we always are, whether we like it or not, we always are predicting the future. Whenever we take an action, we have certain expectations of what is likely to happen. But what I'm saying is that that's something that we're not very well equipped to do, and so we should minimize the cognitive burden on ourselves as much as possible. So in the familiar confines of the private sphere, we certainly aren't infallible there either, but we are more able to predict each other's behavior in most cases, I would say, than predicting the behavior of anonymous hundreds of millions of people. And that's what whoever it is who designs the law, whether it's professional economists or ordinary citizens, or usually it's a combination of experts and legislators and citizen input, journalists input, but none of those people, even someone with a PhD from Harvard or Yale, is qualified to predict the future.
And talking about our own ideas on things, something that you wrote is that ideology is one of the many heuristics by which fallible and ignorant human beings try to make sense of the world. And this is also kind of in context with how people's, you've written before, that people's ideas are inherently inconsistent with so many topics in such a complex world with so many different issues. So, and it kind of draws in to one thing you were saying. People were trying to kind of blame the greedy bankers, but as you're saying, it wasn't that greedy. They were buying AAA-rated backed bonds. So yeah. People are not realizing sometimes their ideologies and the way they cut.
I would say almost always. Almost never do people realize how their ideology is shaping what they think. They may be aware that, I'm a conservative, someone will say, so if I go to a Republican Party meeting or to, I don't know, somewhere, I will find, like here in Texas where I find myself living, I've never been in a place with so many Republicans before. So they say to themselves, I can find other conservatives there, and they'll probably agree with me. But as to why I think X, Y, or Z about different issues, like what caused the financial crisis, it's very hard for people to unless you really try to keep track of it. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's hard for people to tell you or to figure out themselves where they got the impressions that made them form an opinion. So it's a combination of information that they've heard again and again from different sources. If you hear it often enough and the sources are credible enough, then it seems to be unobjectionably true. But also people, I think what you're getting at is that people filter both their judgment of who is a credible source and what's, they filter, they choose what sources they're listening to in the first place. And they, inevitably, when we're bombarded with so much information, we have to seize on some of it as more understandable and more plausible than other information. So, an ideology is just a pretty sophisticated, relatively sophisticated group of ways of judging these issues. If you have conservative parents, or if you go to a liberal college, people aren't going to label themselves, I'm your conservative parent, most of the time. People, the professors aren't going to say, I'm a liberal political science professor. But what they do is they give you information that seems reasonable and objectively true to them. And all information, even if it is objectively true, is just a tiny slice of the available information. You get this stream of information, and before you know it, you're a liberal or you're a conservative, and you don't exactly know how it happened, or you may, but in any case, it has happened through this process of selective retention screening of information that's been going on since we were kids and we first started to learn about the political world. What I was saying in that passage that point that you referred to in something I've written is that just as our eyes only allow us to see a very small amount of the visual data that's out there. We don't see ultraviolet light, for instance. And we don't see all I'm looking at a bookshelf right now, and I don't see it as a patch of blue, a patch of yellow. I see it as that yellow book, that blue book. our eyes and our brains are wired to make sense of the world, and the primary way we do that is screening out most of the information and screening in what we think is important. I mean, our eyes evolved to screen in what would be important to our survival. In politics, we use the same sorts of things, and in all fields, we use the same sorts of things, heuristics, to simplify the world. And ideology is a great simplifier. Not that people say to themselves, I'm just going to be dogmatically conservative or liberal, and whatever Rush Limbaugh says or President Obama says, I'm just going to agree with it. Nobody does that. But if they've been hearing all their lives the sorts of things that Rush Limbaugh or President Obama has been hearing, then when Rush or Barack says those sorts of things, it will resonate with some people, and it won't resonate with other people because it'll be implausible. So what's happened is that what we call liberalism or conservatism has organized the information in people's minds so that they will tend to reach liberal or conservative conclusions.
And as you say, when people complain that it was unfettered capitalism that caused this crisis, they're not taking into account this rule and government rules, as you mentioned, the recourse rule that incentivized banks to invest in mortgage-backed securities when they didn't know that there was a housing bubble.
Yeah, well, people don't even know it. I didn't know it until I happened to read this article that an economist from NYU submitted to Critical Review. They didn't even name this regulation. Later in doing research on the book, or the introduction to Critical Review, I found out that it was called the recourse rule. But I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of regulations that cover many, many pages of the Federal Register, and that's just at the federal level. Each state has hundreds or thousands of regulations too. And we don't know about, I mean, no one can be expected to know about these things if they aren't reported. And reporters can't be expected to know about these things. So it was interesting. I clipped a lot of the coverage in the immediate days following September 15th, 2008, as journalists were trying to figure out what had happened. And you can see them searching around. Really, at first, nobody thought that they knew what had happened. But as soon as a recognizable narrative appeared, such as greedy bankers and deregulation, people latched onto it because it gave them some kind of conceptual anchor in this otherwise very confusing situation. And then those myths just accreted over time. Reuters, or I guess Bloomberg, published an article yesterday where somebody dug up something that we had not gone into one way or the other in the book. But among crisis cognoscenti, people who really are experts on a financial crisis, one of the variants of the deregulation narrative was a rule that the SEC had supposedly passed in 2004, I think, that had allowed investment banks to borrow as much as they wanted to, whereas previously they had been limited in how much they could borrow. And only yesterday, which is what, 4 years after the crisis, did it come out that the rule had absolutely no effect on the actual amount that investment banks borrowed. We go through more conventional versions of the deregulation narrative in the book, like the repeal of a section of the Glass-Steagall Act. That's the form of deregulation that people usually talk about. Without going into the details of why we argue that regulation wasn't very important in causing the financial crisis, the thing is that a few days after the crisis in 2008, whenever this idea first presented itself, it was something that reporters and politicians and citizens could understand. greedy bankers, they weren't regulated heavily enough, or they weren't regulated rigorously enough, and so they went wild for some reason, whether it was irrational exuberance or simple greed, and that caused the crisis. It's really, as someone who was following this at the time, just as a citizen, and I had no idea I would end up writing a book about it, one of the things that interested me enough, I mean, everyone was interested in the financial crisis for obvious reasons, but enough to publish a special issue of Critical Review and then a couple of books on the financial crisis subsequently. Initially, there was this state of confusion that you don't usually see in politics, where nobody, for a few days at least, nobody claimed to have all the answers. But then, as the answers started emerging, over time, opinions hardened. And I gave a talk last week in Houston about the financial crisis to a sort of Tea Party group, I would say. I'm not exactly sure, but they seemed like a Tea Party type of group. And I was telling them the greedy, reckless bankers were not at fault, and they almost lynched me. They knew what had caused the crisis. How did they know? I asked them when they would ask me these questions and point at me and yell at me after my talk. I said, so how do you know that? And they'd say, well, you know, they don't know how they know it. Nobody really does. But eventually it sounded like, well, they'd read it in the newspapers. So the next question is, how do the reporters know that? Well, they ask people. People tell them. How do these people know? Well, these are experts. And so having been on both sides of this, the ordinary citizen side and the so-called expert side, I can tell you that the expert emperors have no clothes. And but when merely offering an opinion at a time of confusion will start to congeal people around that opinion simply because it allows them to orient themselves and understand the world, whether it's accurate or not. Then if you come along years later and say, well, look at this fact, look at the fact that banks bought three times as many of these as other investors, is there some reason that bankers would be more greedy than other investors? Or is it that there was this regulation that applied only to bankers? People, by that point, have thought and read enough about the financial crisis and even seen movies about it that they're not going to be persuaded. And I'm not accusing them of being dogmatic. I'm accusing them simply of being human. And it is human nature that as you learn more and more about something and you become more and more convinced about an opinion about that issue, you will objectively be dogmatic, even if it doesn't come with the emotion and the anger that I experienced in Houston.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium. Thanks so much to Dr. Jeffrey Friedman for speaking with us about his book, Engineering the Financial Crisis. Have a great day.
Houston.